Very warm welcome to everybody to this seminar on transnational organized crime in the Western Balkans, effects in the region and beyond. The event is part of the ongoing RATIU Forum 2020 Vision Series, which explores important and topical issues facing Central and Southeast Europe. The event is co-organized with the RATIU Forum, as well as the Belgrade Center for Security Policy and the LSE Ideas Central and Southeast Europe program. The event is recorded and will be made into a podcast, which will be available on the LSE Ideas website. We'll begin with a short presentation from each of the speakers, maximum about 8 to 10 minutes, followed by a discussion among them, reflecting on points raised by each. After that, members of the audience will be able to ask questions of the speakers in a Q&A session, so please feel free to post your questions using the Q&A button at the bottom of your screens. Well, we have four eminent speakers who I'll introduce properly before they each speak, but to give an orientation of the order of appearance, we'll start with Dr. Walter Kemp, Director of the Southeastern Europe Observatory Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime, followed by Bojan Elek, Senior Researcher at Belgrade Center for Security Policy, and then Vanya Chalovic, Executive Director, Mance, Montenegro, and Professor Dr. Anna Maria Getoš Kalats, Head of Balkan Criminology, University of Zagreb's Faculty of Law. So start off with a talk by Walter Kemp. As I said, he's the Director of the Observatory of Illicit Economies in Southeastern Europe and Fellow of the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime. He's also a Strategic Policy Advisor at the Geneva Center for Security Policy, and teaches at the Diplomatic Academy in Vienna. Dr. Kemp has many years of experience as a senior advisor in the OSCE, was spokesman and speechwriter at the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, and vice president of the International Peace Institute. He's written extensively on organized crime, conflict prevention, inter-ethnic issues, and the OSCE. So, Walter, over to you.
Thanks very much, Professor Bartlett. And I have to say it's a real pleasure and an honor to take part in this event. I graduated from the LSE 25 years ago. I don't think I've spoken at an LSE event since then. So I'm very glad to be part of this discussion in this panel talking about the impact of organized crime in the Western Balkans, but also from the Western Balkans. I work for something called the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime. This is truly a global network of experts who are analyzing organized crime around the world, looking at the risks, but also trying to build resilience. And we have a team that looks at illicit economies in Southeastern Europe. And for the past 3 years, we've been writing a series of reports on hotspots of organized crime in the Western Balkans. And what we noticed after the first one is that there are relatively high rates of criminality in some countries of the region, but there's not a very big market for organized crime in the Western Balkans. These countries are relatively small with small populations. It's very much a region of transit, or in some cases like cannabis, a region of supply. And so we started to look more deeply. If there is this reputation of organized crime associated with the Western Balkans, and yet there's not that much of it in the region, where is the problem, or is it a myth? And so we did a report called Transnational Tentacles, which came out last year, which looked at the activities of criminal groups from the Western Balkans outside the region. And so we focused on Latin America, on Western Europe, South Africa, Australia, and other places. And what we saw was that over the last 20 years, criminals from the Western Balkans have moved up the value chain in organized crime. So again, we weren't focusing on the region, we were looking at these groups outside the region. So in the 1970s and 80s, you see there were people coming from Yugoslavia, really not many at Albania, from Albania, because it was such a closed society, but who were involved in burglaries. Some of them were hitmen, but they were at a relatively low level of criminal activity, very much involved, for example, in the delivery of cannabis and heroin. But over the last 20 years, they have used the profits of this original type of criminal activity to move up the supply chain, particularly into cocaine now in the past 10 years or so, in Latin America and in Western Europe. And as a result, have a more or less end-to-end delivery of a highly valuable commodity, and have managed, particularly through economics, but also through violence, to muscle their way into this lucrative market and almost control the whole supply chain from the source to the destination. We looked into why this was so. Clearly, they're very effective operators. They're able to operate in communities abroad, very much through their diasporas, but in some cases there were no diasporas, like in many countries of Latin America. They, in some cases, have effective language skills. They're clearly good at deal making, effectively use technology both for communication but also for moving money. We saw that there's quite a high degree of inter-ethnic cooperation. So this idea of the Balkans being a place of only inter-ethnic conflict in the case of organized crime, that's not so much the case. You will get violent competition between groups, but they may very often be from the same country or even from the same community, for example, the rival clans in Montenegro. That said, we don't think that there's a Balkan cartel, which is sometimes an expression used journalistically. It's not that organized as organized crime. We also noticed that these groups at the high end are very effective at moving their money, either investing locally where they are or moving their money offshore or laundering it in the Western Balkans. In terms of enabling factors, one of the big ones is weak criminal justice systems in the countries where they're operating, not always, for example, in Western Europe, but certainly in some countries of Latin America, but also in the places where they're from. And as a result, there's also sometimes not very good cooperation between countries of the Western Balkans and places rather far away, like in Latin America or in South Africa. These groups have been rather lucky in terms of their timing with the major growth in the cocaine market, both in terms of supply and demand in the last few years. They've kind of been in the right place at the right time. They have a reputation, a kind of fear factor. Also we noticed, particularly in the case of Latin America, but in some countries of Western Europe as well, there's a relative misunderstanding of the Balkans among law enforcement agents. Even in Spain, they didn't make the distinction between criminal groups or actors from Albania or Montenegro. In some cases in Ecuador, they referred to the Russians. They were actually talking about Serbs or Montenegrins. So the lack of language skills, the lack of knowledge of the Western Balkans from law enforcement outside the region is certainly a hindering factor in dealing with this issue. And in some cases, not least because of the money that they make, they can operate under an umbrella of protection, either abroad or in some cases back in the region. The impact in the Western Balkans is that, firstly, it hurts the reputation of the region. We've seen in the process of EU accession, the sense that there is a problem with organized crime and corruption in the Western Balkans, which is partly a reflection of the situation in the Western Balkans, but it's also a reflection of attitudes in countries, including the Netherlands and the UK, where these groups have been quite active. You have the influx of dirty money in some cases, which can buy assets, but also can buy power and protection. You have the problem of violence. Sometimes groups operating abroad are then settling their scores back home. There can be an impact on politics in some cases. We've then recently tried to put this in a context. If you're interested, last week we issued the first ever global index of organized crime. And that looks at all 193 countries, member states of the United Nations. So Kosovo is not in it, although there is some information on Kosovo. But it looks at the risk of criminal activities from these countries, including the Western Balkans, but also the resilience, to what extent the societies are able to fend off or have social antibodies to this problem. So in short, there is a major problem with organized crime from groups in the Western Balkans, but also now, I would argue, more for the groups from the Western Balkans operating outside the region. This has an impact on security in the countries where they operate, but also back into the region. And it very much shows the transnational nature and impact of organized crime, and therefore why dealing with it will also require a more effective multilateral response, both in the region, but also between the region and countries where these groups are active.
Thanks very much. Well, sir, thanks for keeping nicely in time and for presenting that fascinating view of the sort of supply chain, global supply chain for the organized crime groups, which is quite amazing. So we move on now to Bojan Elek, who is a senior researcher at the Belgrade Center for Security Policy. It's a leading think tank specializing in security issues in the Western Balkans. And he specializes in European enlargement, Union enlargement policy and Serbia's European integration, with a special focus on monitoring reform in the rule of law and security. He's the coordinator of the Western Balkans Organized Crime Radar, a regional network of think tanks researching organized crime and monitoring government policies in the area. Bojan will touch upon the global presence of local Western Balkan gangs, but will and give some examples, but we'll also focus more broadly on the connections with broader issues such as democratization and state capture. So Bojan, over to you.
Thank you, Professor Bartlett. I can also start by saying that I'm also very pleased to be able to present this forum with other panelists. And just to kind of pick up from where Walter left off, when we talk about the Western Balkans, maybe for the viewers to just clarify, what do we think? You all probably have heard about the Balkans route, if not in relation to organized crime, then for sure during the migration and refugee crisis. But maybe just to clarify what it actually is comprised of. So it's when we speak about the Western Balkans, it's usually post-Yugoslav countries, so former Yugoslavia, with Albania added to it, and then Slovenia taken from this equation. So when we talk about the organized crime in the Western Balkans, we primarily refer to these. And then I wanted to structure my first eight minutes, but I think we can definitely have a very fruitful discussion later. I wanted to maybe provide an answer why, how come that organized crime groups from this region became so omnipotent globally and became, like Walter said, they moved up the value chains, and they now involve the very lucrative cocaine smuggling to Europe. But this is, let's say, on one side, but on the other side, they're also, particularly Albanian crime groups, they are the ones that are again in charge of smuggling heroin into Europe via the Balkan route, which is, so like Walter said already, Western Balkans is a transit region, and the consumption is very low, but it has been featured very prominently on the global criminal landscape. So to start off, maybe from this external point of view, the way that you from the UK, for example, see the Western Balkans, it's usually when there is a big bust of narco cartel. For example, last week, Europol had a very successful action, and Balkan narco cartel was busted with 61 person involved. More than 20 people were arrested, and 2.6 tons of cocaine were was seized. It was a very big international action. Like Walter said, this is the key in tackling international organized crime, the law enforcement cooperation. But also over the past couple of years, Europol and UNODC, for example, they I matched some numbers between 2018 2020. just in Europe, more than 260 ethnic Albanians were arrested in relation to cocaine smuggling, and plus 84 more from Croatia, Montenegro, Bosnia and Herzegovina in Serbia. So it is a fact that these are all very present. And then I think it's really important what Walter mentioned, that it's moving up the value chain, actually. For example, if we look at the case of Darko Šarić and his criminal gang, which was he was only recently sentenced to a prison time in Serbia, but the international law enforcement cooperation that brought this gang down took place more than 10 years ago. So they took over his gang took over a cocaine market from 'Ndrangheta in Italy in 2008-2009. They were offering lower price and better products, so completely took over the market. And then they had they had billions in a network that they brought back to the region. And they were this dirty money, corrosive capital, whatever is still present there. So I think what is really interesting is that from this external point of view, there is this bad reputation of the Western Balkans when it comes to being origin countries of organized crime groups. Yes, we are exporting organized crime to Europe. It has to do a lot with the conflicts in the 90s, with the poverty, with all these other things. But it's also, I think, important to take a look at how this organized crime is affecting our countries internally. This is not something that is necessarily on front pages of newspapers. But I think some shared traits of the Western Balkan countries that made them vulnerable to organized crime is that these are mostly weak, failed, or unfinished states. There is no good cooperation of law enforcement between them. There is endemic corruption and poverty. We are all post-conflict societies, as I mentioned. We've had a history of having strong security institutions with weak oversight. And I think this is where we're getting at what is very peculiar about the Balkan organized crime, is that there has always been this very prominent link between the state or the political elite with organized crime groups. And I think that's a very unique for our region. We have during the 90s, for example, I lived during a sanctioned period in Yugoslavia, what it was called. Criminality was so normalized at the time. Everybody had to dabble in crime to be able to survive, smuggling cigarettes, smuggling petroleum, for example. So this is where this initial seed of what we see now has been sought. And these are just the consequences 20 years later. But maybe to provide a couple of examples of how it's actually from the inside, this huge criminal influence on one hand, and it's present. I mean, we have this what we call state capture in the region, where we have intermingling of politics, business, crime, media, even green economy, because that is also an area where organized crime found a way to earn extra profits by investing in green economy. So it's a very hub to disentangle and to understand. So politics plays a really big part. I will give you one example. For example, if you follow the developments between Kosovo and Serbia, the so-called dialogue on normalization between the two, you might get an impression that there is no cooperation between Kosovo and Serbian government, and including law enforcement agencies. However, when it comes to the organized crime groups that operate between Serbia and Kosovo, this cooperation has been exemplary. And for example, I'll give you in 2019, Kosovo introduced tariffs on Serbian goods. And at the same time, these organized criminal groups actually took over this legal trade. So you would still be able to find Serbian goods bought in Kosovo market. And they were brought illegally via the so-called alternative crossing points, where there is no police control and it's very difficult to police the border. So there were even investigative pieces of journalists went there, talked to the locals. Organized crime groups would actually pay the locals to monitor the roads through which this traffic was taking place. So this is how well and how deep these issues are are in the region. Another really, really important issue is the what happens with all this profit that comes into the region from these mostly cocaine smuggling abroad. And then we, particularly in Serbia, but also in other countries, if you visited recently, we've had this explosion in real estate construction, where we have incredibly expensive prices for example, one square meter. If you want to buy a flat in Belgrade, one square meter would cost 10 times the median income. I think that's as if it would cost maybe 20,000 in pounds in the UK. So it's only as a consequence of a lot of dirty money coming and then being laundered through real estate, to property sales. And this has been noticed in, for example, US global drug strategy. Serbia was also gray listed or blacklisted, let's say, by the Financial Action Task Force, which is a international body in charge of monitoring how well countries deal with money laundering. And for example, Serbia was put on a blacklist because it had serious deficiencies in this regard. And maybe just to illustrate with an example, and maybe to finish this part of my presentation here, is how actually the government took over these recommendations by this Financial Action Task Force, and the legislation that was actually destined to tackle money launderers and use it against civil society organizations. This is part of the state capture that we are talking about, and this intermingling of various interests. So the government actually introduced new legislation, and under this legislation that had to deal with the prevention of financing of terrorism and money laundering, started investigating civil society organizations, NGOs, including mine, and we were actually targeted by the anti-money laundering body of the Serbian government for this and under investigation. This data that they obtained on us was later used to run a smear campaign against civil society organizations. And there are many other examples that I wanted to also share, but maybe we can do it in the second part. But I think what really is to maybe underline is that these shared characteristics that we've about the countries in the region that kind of brought closer these criminal groups. Maybe just to go through them. So as I said, weak, failed, unfinished states, issues with the cooperation of law enforcement, and this has improved a little bit recently with the, for example, EU becoming a player in the region and all the countries wanting to join the EU. So there has been some improvement, still not enough. We've had endemic corruption, poverty, and the key issue, I would say, it's the state capture. The key question actually remains, how do you effectively fight organized crime in a country where you have criminal and political elites intertwined? Who is the one who should take and lead this fight against organized crime? And I think now it has become an issue in the region of not how do you develop effective anti-organized crime policies. It is more about how we effectively democratize the countries and how we make them more democratic. I think this would be the key challenge in the future. And this is it for me for now.
Okay, thanks. Thanks very much, Bojan. I think you've brought out very clearly the links between the sort of global supply chains, value chains that Walsa was talking about, and the domestic repercussions and interlinkages between organized crime and politics. So yes, hopefully we'll be able to get more into that as we open the discussion up. So now we'll move on to presentation by Vanya Chalovic, who is the executive director of the Montenegrin nonprofit CSO MANS. And she is in charge of overall coordination of the organization's activities, which comprise the fight against corruption and organized crime in Montenegro. She's been very prominent recently in the media, and especially in relation to the recent release of new information about the foreign holdings of property and wealth abroad of high-level persons, politically exposed persons throughout the world and in the Balkans also. I believe she's going to have to rush off after this seminar to another media event. So, Vanya, over to you.
Thank you very much. Well, things are pretty intensive in Montenegro these days, ever since we have experienced the first ever change of the government in our history. Basically, it was the first time that we changed the government on the election polls. But I'll come back to that. First of all, thank you very much for the invitation. I would agree very much with the previous speakers that organized crime groups in the Balkans, in Montenegro in particular, further strengthened and really became powerful global players due to the war and to the development of their capacities during the war. First of all, we have to understand that during the war, all the official institutions basically fell apart. And the only thing the only connections that really existed between the criminals, including the criminals who were smuggling various goods that were necessary for survival of the people. But more importantly for our discussion, also criminals that were with the state support in coordination of the state and in cooperation with Italian organized crime groups, in particular Sacra Corona Unita at the time, organizing smuggling of cigarettes through Montenegrin territory. And that's something which was very important for building these very strong connections between people working in institutions of the system, in particular in the intelligence, in the police, the people who should stop the crime from happening, actually building up partnership between these people and the people from organized crime groups, including from Italian organized crime groups. Secondly, during the war, that was the period during the war was an excellent opportunity for organized crime groups to recruit some people with very specific knowledge, people who used to work in intelligence or the police and or the army, and who got a very specific trainings in certain matters that were very valuable for organized crime groups. In addition, the connections these people had, both throughout the region and with other countries, with their counterparts in other countries, also made these groups even more effective in actually gathering their own intelligence and making sure that they are able to infiltrate in and use the connections with police and institutions, not only in Montenegro or the region, but even wider. During the war, it was something that was more or less accepted by the public. That's when our that deterioration of values started happening, which is very important because right now quite significant number of people do not really consider some people involved in organized crime as the bad guys. We even had, quite recently, a couple of years ago, we had public petitions that people were signing in relation to Šarić and Kalić case, two narco bosses that were wanted by the prosecution in some period. These people were investing in communities, and they continue to invest in communities, and not only highly prominent political people who are apparently involved in organized crime, but also criminals on lower level. They invest in communities, they support members of their communities, also in economic sense. They invest the dirty money in local economies, which is the only alternative for these people not to go abroad. So that is something that also started during the 90s, where the, at the time Prime Minister of Montenegro, Mr. Djukanovic, was explaining to the public that's only way for us to survive. The interestingly, the public, the officials were claiming that all that money was coming to support pensions and to support social endangered in Montenegro. But in Montenegrin parliament at the time, it was publicly stated that some of the members of the government, some ministers actually had private accounts that kept the money from these transactions on private accounts. At the time, the public had never found out, not only then, but even by now, who were the ministers, how much money are we talking about, or we have never seen any evidences that that money was actually channeled back to the country after the smuggling officially was over. The smuggling was never over. The smuggling is not over even now, especially when it comes to the cigarettes, but also when it comes to cocaine, heroin, and quite a few other illicit goods. But let's go a little bit fast forward from the war. Then we experienced so-called transition, which was an excellent opportunity for money laundering. It was also an excellent opportunity for the criminal groups dealing with illicit goods to continue doing their job. But at that time, Montenegro came into the focus, international focus for the money laundering, for cigarette smuggling. Our prime minister was even accused in Italy. There was a case in Switzerland regarding money laundering happening in cooperation of Montenegrin and Italian criminal groups. So our guys simply moved. They moved to Macedonia, then they moved to Romania and Bulgaria. They used that know-how that they developed. They used these connections to simply move to other country where there was much less international intention happening. And that's what they are capable of. That's what we have to be aware of, that if there are some changes happening in one of the Balkan countries, that doesn't mean that we're going to sort out the issue, because these people will simply move because the connections within the region are so strong. During privatization, during transition period, a lot of privatizations happened in a very murky way. One of them was, which was really interesting, was privatization of the biggest company in the country called the aluminium plant of Podgorica. It was sold to a Russian tycoon, Oleg Deripaska, who was somewhere in that period forbidden to enter the United States because FBI believed that he has links with organized crime in Russia. Oleg Deripaska is one of the famous oligarchs from Russia, very close to the president of Russia. And when he was coming to privatize Montenegrin company in a very murky conditions, we were complaining about whether his money is dirty and everything. Mr. Sergei Shoigu, at that time a minister for extraordinary situations, have said that Russia wasn't questioning the money that was coming from Montenegro during the war. And why are we now questioning the money coming from Russia? But maybe that money is the Montenegrin money coming back home. And that's the sentence which is of extreme importance even nowadays. And that's the reason why our prosecution have never, ever conducted any serious financial investigation of any high-level organized crime, whether it's cigarettes or cocaine or heroin or anything, because they wouldn't know where the financial investigation would lead them, and they were afraid that it would lead all the way to the top and to Mr. Djukanovic, to his closest friends and his closest surrounding. So during all that transition and privatization period, of course, the problem was that these groups started more seriously dealing with cocaine smuggling, with heroin smuggling. They developed direct connections with groups in Latin America. We saw that some of the seizures of Montenegrin groups, mostly happening, of course, in other countries, were showing that there was a really high quality of the cocaine that was seized, which was showing that they were really like second or third hand in the worst case. Of course, the money was put in the construction, not only of foreign investors, mainly Russians, and other murky investors who were coming from through various offshore destinations, but also the money from the drugs. In some cases, it was very obvious, and there are evidences, was put into the construction in Montenegro and then further used for laundering the money and selling to various offshore companies. Montenegrin criminal groups during that time, when we had a huge inflow of Russian capital, were also developing cooperation with not only criminal groups from that country, but also we had many very shady people coming from other countries which are experiencing issues with the rule of law. So one of the biggest investments in Montenegro is coming from Azerbaijan. We have investments from former Thai prime minister accused for money laundering and for corruption, etc., etc. Interestingly, when we're talking about cocaine, it's not only the state protection that these people basically enjoyed, because they were never or nearly never caught with anything big and serious. Our police and prosecution for years were catching only marijuana, which was coming from Albania, nothing when it comes to cocaine. It was all seized in other countries. But also, interestingly, they had the infrastructure in Montenegro, which they needed to facilitate the smuggling. So we had quite a few ports which were owned by persons, top-level persons from organized crime. For example, one port was owned by close friend and member of Šarić group and of the Balkan Warrior case, And not only he owned his own board, he owned two ships, and he put the money in constructing two more ships, which continued coming to Montenegro, bringing, interestingly, cement from Latin America. So this was also nothing was seized, even though these ships were permanently seized in Spain, in France, in the UK, and in quite a few other countries with cocaine on it, of course. As I mentioned you before, we had a few cases where the prosecution actually initiated indictments against individuals involved in high-level smuggling of cocaine and heroin, in particular the Sharic and Kalic case. But in both cases, they failed. Not only they failed to prove what was happening, but the property that they confiscated was poorly managed. So now we have to pay for, first of all, the soul pains, and then also devastation of the property of the criminal bosses. And they can never be sued again for the same crimes. So we are happy when our prosecution doesn't process the case. It's much better because the terms of expiring when you can, I forgot the word in English, sorry, how long you can actually process them are quite long for organized crime. So it's much better that it waits for some other prosecution, which will not be under control of political structures close to organized crime, than actually finding them not guilty because the prosecution made so many intentional mistakes in these cases and no one was ever held accountable. So I could talk about this for a long, long time. I mean, I'm coming from Montenegro and we have so many examples. And let's come back to the to today's moment. We have a new government, which is a big thing for Montenegro because it never really happened. And that government is far from being stable. There is a lot of noise. There is a political noise, but there are a lot influences from other countries, political and other influences, including financial influences, including in elections. So situation is very complicated. And you know how organized crime loves it when the government is not really strong and when there are so many other voices happening. So it's going to be very challenging. First of all, we will see whether the new government really has a strong political will, because we wouldn't be the first country where the new government would, or parts of the new government would take over some of the illicit businesses. We saw that happening in many other countries. I hope that won't be the case in Montenegro. So the will is one thing, but that's not all. It's about the power as well. Would they be able and powerful enough to dismantle the whole system, basically? Because the system was set in such a way to enable smuggling, to facilitate smuggling. Just one little example on the cigarettes, which I'm currently dealing with. So I'm mostly familiar with that, for example. So you have this software of the customs authorities in Montenegro, which is really beautiful. A lot of money was invested in it from UK, Germany, Americans, etc. Just one little detail, it doesn't at all include the free trade zone of the port of Bar. At all, like not a single information. There is no archiving system, there is no basic data about what's coming to Montenegro and leaving Montenegro. And I can tell you that some simple statistics is showing that about 3 billion cigarettes per year are disappearing, or Montenegrins are somehow smoking them. So that's pretty much saying how much the just one example how the system was set in order not to catch the smuggling. So it's hard to define the priorities. It's hard to find people who understand the system, because only people who were close to the previous regime were actually able to work in the system. Now it's really hard to find those who are able, who have a practical knowledge in some specific issues, including the customs, the taxes, the financial investigations, etc., to actually do the job. But it also takes the courage. It takes a lot of courage, because we saw in some countries what happened to those prominent political figures who dared to go after organized crime. And it takes knowledge. And I honestly think the knowledge is the least of the problems if the other ones are fulfilled, because there are so many international experts who are willing to help. We should just ask for it. But we should honestly ask for it, and we should have a strong political will to say that there will be no taking over of the dirty businesses of the former government. So thank you very much. I hope I wasn't too long.
Yeah, that was perfect. Thank you very much, Vanya, for giving us all that insight into the detail of organized crime in Montenegro and the connection between the organized crime groups and the government and the weak rule of law and so on, how that all interlinks. So I'm sure we'll come back to that. We've got a few questions already for you, so you have a chance to elaborate a little bit on that. Okay, so let's move on now to the final speaker of this introductory session, Anna Maria Getosh Kalatz, who holds a tenured associate professorship at the University of Zagreb's Faculty of Law, where she's been conducting criminological research and teaching criminology, victimology, penology, and the basics of criminal law since 2006. Anna Maria has initiated the Balkan Criminology Research Group, which is funded by the Max Planck Society, which has revived criminological research in Croatia and the Balkans. So she's going to try to explain to us a little bit about the causes of all this extraordinary development in the region. So thank you. Over to you, Anna Maria.
Thank you for this kind introduction and hello to everybody. Thanks for tuning in. When it comes to funding, I also need to thank the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime, who has since 2019 continued to fund our work and essentially made major parts of our research endeavor possible. What I will do in the next 8 to 10 minutes is to summarize some of the issues that have already been addressed in a way that I will try to structure them on one slide. This deals primarily with the root causes and accelerators of organized crime in the Balkans. The thing I will start with is to provide you with a little bit of thoughts and challenges when it comes to methodological and conceptual questions, and also I would say problems or challenges, however you want to phrase it, when talking about organized crime, not specifically and only in the Balkans, but also in general, because it is a tricky concept, I would say, to frame, and it's even trickier to do research on it, and even more trickier if you want to do it in a valid, reliable, and comparative way throughout regions, especially if you want to go global. And at the end, I will finalize my brief talk with what I tried to do for Balkan organized crime in terms of coming up with a rough typology. And from this, we will hopefully see what I also see as the major problem when it comes to organized crime in the Balkans. I will share my screen with you. So I guess they had a typical question in times of online presenting. Do you see my screen? Yeah, okay, great. To come back to the issue of concepts and methodology when you talk about organized crime, I mean, if you take a step back from the phenomenology that was greatly presented by the talkers before me, basically, what's the problem with organized crime? Yeah, what is the uniqueness and what is the particular dangerousness that arises out of organized crime? So when we look at all the definitions dealing with organized crime, we can say there are two main points. One is that at least two persons have to be engaged principally in any kind of criminal activity. This is one criteria. The other criteria is that there has to be a certain level of continuity in this criminal activity and or a certain level of organization behind it. Now, from this and from a criminological or if you want sociological point of view, this covers a huge area of criminal activity, persons, groups, and markets. So in essence, this ranges from three people teaming up, stealing cars for a living. And for this, although it clearly falls under the definition and the concept of organized crime, I would say this is also normal criminals, yeah, which in that sense do not correspond to what we just heard, to those phenomena that the talkers before me named. So at the end of the line, we have mafia-style groups, we have huge markets in illegal goods, and clearly when talking about organized crime, we talk about a lot of different things, yeah, for which I think there is a huge lack in basic conceptualization so that we are all clear when we talk about organized crime in general, but also in the Balkans, that we exactly know what we talk about. I will come back to these different types at the end of my talk. Another methodologically very tricky challenge is the question of how do we detect, how do we observe, and at the end, how do we count organized crime? Looking through reports on organized crime in the Western Balkans, the great ones done by the Global Initiative, but also by the UNODC, or rather recently, and another study done by the Syracuse Institute. There is a question of the dark figure of crime. Those cases that have not been registered officially and not prosecuted, these were mentioned repeatedly. And when it comes to organized crime, we assess that the dark figure is huge. However, we don't really know it, because that's the dark figure of crime, yeah? And this poses a particular problem for research, but also for policy in terms of preventing and combating organized crime. And this brings us to criminal state capture, where one can assume that the dark figure is even bigger than in other countries. So the dark figure of organized crime is not only a challenge in the Balkans, but also in other European regions. But I would argue that it is a particular challenge in our region, since here we have the problem of weak and failed states, or how Boyer nicely framed it, I wrote it down, unfinalized states, or I would say states under construction, yeah. It brings us to another methodological issue. What are we counting? Yeah, are we counting persons, individuals? Are we counting the groups, the different criminal groups? Are we counting the offenses they commit, or are we talking about the markets they operate or engage in? Which brings us to another, I would say, most tricky question in that line of thought, and that is the assessment of different illegal market values. How do you assess that? Yeah. How do we assess that? How much value and market purchase is created. Now, why is this all a challenge? Not only out of purely methodological issues, but it has a very practical impact. And that is the lack of accepted methodology in organized crime research is the major obstacle in comparative analysis, not only through different regions or within the same country, but even more throughout time when we talk about trends. It's very difficult to say what organized crime was in terms of value, persons, organizations involved 10 years ago, what it is now. And this is very difficult to track, especially if you want to do evidence-based crime policy, and if you also want to evaluate the legal instruments and also the policing and the prosecuting that has been done against organized crime. So this is basically the setting in which research on organized crime is being conducted. And I see such a situation as, how to phrase it nicely, awaiting improvement. And I think this is another excellent opportunity to have experts gathered around, but also an interested audience where this can be discussed with the aim to improve such a situation. Now, I won't go into too much detail, but essentially I think that these points cover, but also add a little bit to the root causes and the accelerators we see throughout the Balkans when it comes to organized crime. Clearly there, in terms of root causes, we have a favorable geostrategic position. We have had, I would say, long-lasting tradition in failed foreign domination and dictatorships, causing also an ethnic mosaic. There is a tradition, and I don't mean this in a pejorative way, but there is clearly a tradition of banditry throughout the region, going back to the Ottoman Empire, we have a very, and this is something we see even today, a very shady connection with the private security sector and criminal groups. This is not something that started after the wars. This was clearly present even during the time of former Yugoslavia. We have a tradition of informal economies, and also very clearly a culture of impunity. Yeah, no one's responsible for anything, and let alone that someone gets prosecuted or finally convicted for something. And very high value of what I call importance or bitnost, biti bitan. That is something very specific for the region, which I think people from the Balkans will understand the best. Importance is a not good translation, but I think it's a certain phenomenon we witness in the Balkans. And this also very nicely explains corruption throughout the region. The accelerators have already been mentioned. This is just to structure it a little bit. So here we have the crime conflict nexus. We have the crime politics nexus. Here we would say that is also the problem of criminal state capture, which in my point of view has a lot to do with political and economic transition we witnessed throughout the region. But also the crime terror nexus, which today has not been mentioned, but I think is also of particular relevance. And this brings me to the last point I would like to make, and that is what happens when we look at Balkan organized crime types by their apparent legality or illegality. So as I mentioned at the beginning, we have a lot of small and semi-specialized criminal groups and networks which engage in what I would say in criminological terms comes down to the normal criminal, which simply organizes. And these are professional criminals, which by definition are also organized crime. These are obviously, very obviously illegal. Yeah. And usually followed by the next type, and that would be corporate type mafia. Now, they are very well known for trying to reach a higher level of legality in their apparent appearance, followed by private sector security. Usually these are war and intelligence veterans, but in some occasions we even witness people from the security and intelligence sector, which are even while working there, working closely or even for and part of criminal networks. And then we get to the level of basically legitimate businesses with close political ties, which operate clearly within the criminal domain. And with this, we see that the apparent legality of these groups rises as we go down the list. And this brings us to the last group that I call high impact interest groups, or the basically the untouchables of organized crime throughout the Balkans. Now, interestingly, as I say, the legality as we go down the list rises. But so does the security threat and the threat for the states they pose. Now, even more interestingly, the law enforcement attention, yeah, is much higher at the bottom of the list, or at the top of this list, if you want to go like that. Whereas, and this is really specific for the Balkans, I think the untouchables explain not only criminal state capture, but also why we are still at the very beginning of dealing with organized crime on that level where it really matters. And coming back to my first slide, on that level where we essentially see what the concept of organized crime should actually be targeting. And that is the uniqueness of organized crime and the dangerousness, because organized crime is not only crime, but it is a threat to the rule of law, and it is a threat to the sovereign state. And with this, I would essentially finish my presentation and give it back to you.
Okay, thank you very much, Anna Maria, for that tour de force of analysis of the broad issues involved. Starting off from how to measure organized crime through to the sort of legacies of the region. I found particularly interesting the your reference to the former Yugoslavia. I think the legacies there could be explored productively. And onwards to the the current sort of hierarchy of criminal groups towards greater legality, whereas the investigation, police investigations, go more towards the bottom end of this pyramid. So I think that's absolutely spot on. So we've got a few minutes to just offer the panelists a few moments to raise any particular observations they had of the other speakers' presentations before we open up to discussion. We've got a few very interesting questions coming up already in the Q&A box. So I'll try to ask you to be brief in your discussion. I mean, perhaps Walter, you'd like to kick off. I mean, you have heard quite a lot about the views from the region and the sort of theoretical exposition. What do you make of it? Does it fit with your sort of more global supply chain analysis?
Absolutely. And I think people from the region see these issues and problems much more closely than those of us on the outside. And also, I have to say that many of the trends and problems that have been identified in the panel are not unique to the Western Balkans. I encourage you to have a look at this first ever global index of organized crime. It points out, and this was pretty shocking for me, that state embedded actors are the most dominant criminal actor type in the world. So this trend that we see in the Balkans, which is certainly worse than in Western Europe, is however not unique to the Western Balkans. The type of connections that were mentioned, close links between political, business and criminal elites and the problem of state capture and so on, that is certainly a challenge. And Sarah's put up in the chat there a link to the index. Many interesting questions in the Q&A. Happy to take on any of those later. But really interesting panel, good discussion, and brave and outspoken colleagues. I think this is what we need more of, and this is what we try and encourage in the global initiative. That if we can't tackle this problem necessarily from the top down, then we have to tackle it from the bottom up by strengthening resilience, strengthening civil society, and investigative journalism, NGOs, and kind of show that there's not a helplessness, that this is something that can be changed, albeit very slowly. That said, I think there's also a strong need for external pressure. I think it's interesting that President Biden issued an executive order in June, which was blocking property and suspending entry into the U.S. of certain people. You can see the political pressure that's been exerted in the past by the EU, at one point calling North Macedonia state capture, but also positive support, working together with Europol, working together to support criminal justice reform, for example, in Albania. So this is that change may not come from within the countries necessarily. It may need a lot of external pressure.
Okay. Thanks very much for those thoughts, Walter. I think we might move on actually to the open sort of question and answer session, because we have got quite a few very interesting questions. And then unless there are very specific points at which the speakers want to jump in on each other's comments further. But one question in particular is looking at a rather interesting connection between the Balkans and the major powers. It may follow on nicely on what Walter was just saying. And it's, I think, rather questioning whether the EU and the US are actually neutral players who can sort of really support the bottom-up initiatives. But it's from Kurt Bassuner, if I pronounce that correctly. To anyone on the panel who wishes to take it, it seems to me that the posture of the EU and the US has been to effectively abet state capture. That means effectively assist state capture and politically protected organized crime in the Western Balkans by not applying blunt pressure on their partners at the commanding heights of the captured states. What would you recommend civic actors and citizens should do if they want to see EU and US policies become more effective in pressing for legal and democratic accountability?
If I may jump in on that and maybe also offer a couple more thoughts. So this is actually a really key question, I would say, because the very little of the fight against organized crime that is taking place in the region is actually due to the pressure, mostly stemming from the EU. Just to maybe remind the listeners that all of the Western Balkans, at least at a declaratory level, expressed a desire to join the EU, and we are all at different stages of accession talks. Some are potential candidate countries, some are candidate countries, and Montenegro and Serbia are actually the only ones that are having negotiations, and we are negotiating currently. So yeah, I mean, a lot has been said about the effects of this enlargement fatigue, call it, or the way that the EU is kind of restructuring right now and cannot take new members in, and how this has affected state capture in the region, but also fight against organized crime. Yes, fight against organized crime is at the top of priorities for the EU in the Western Balkans, primarily because of their own internal concerns. So has it been effective? What the EU insists on is having final convictions using some very sophisticated tools of financial investigations, asset seizures, all these things. But for example, UNODC issued a report last year where it found, UNODC is the UN Office on Drug and Crime, and they found that in the Western Balkans, they tried to measure how effective the government was in tackling organized crime. Actually, they found that the number of indictments grew six times, whereas the number of final convictions halved, which means it's 12 times less effective, the fight against organized crime, than it used to be. And this is this can be explained from the point of view of state capture, because the executive, having influence on judiciary, the prosecution, insists on having mass arrests. For example, in Serbia, there have been so many mass arrests where 100 random people would be arrested that this would be presented as a fight against organized crime. But then when it comes to the court, there is no enough evidence, the indictment does not stand, and these people just leave. I mean, they let go. So this is one of the issues. And then how actually EU, there has been a recent paper published about how actually EU is complicit in enabling state capture, because it allows the executive, it provides so much legitimacy to the executives when they have these high-level meetings. For example, in Serbia in September, we had Ursula von der Leyen, the head of the European Commission, and Angela Merkel visiting the president of Serbia 2 weeks apart. But so having these very high-level interactions, they buy legitimacy. At the same time, the EU insists on having political, but also economic reforms at the same time. And this kind of leads to creation of these clientelistic networks. I think Vanya talked about this before. So this has been going on throughout transition, but it is also happening under the EU's eye, I guess, now. So yeah, this would be some of the thoughts on this question. And I'm not sure if I should go into the next one about, there is one question that is directed to me by Professor Joseph, I want to say, from SAIS, about the Belyuk affair, if I may go on maybe, let somebody else fill in. So yeah, so Belyuk is the most prominent case of fight against organized crime in Serbia at the time. I mean, it's arguably whether it is actually fight at all, or it's some kind of a media spectacle with some, we don't know what is the reason behind it. So just to maybe bring everybody else up to speed, Belyuk is Velja Nevolja, or Velja the Trouble. It's a very prominent case that we have in Serbia right now. So this group led by this Belyuk has been growing, and they have become the biggest criminal gang in Serbia. And there were some, we have some very amazing reporters in the region, and they've all uncovered many links between the Serbian government, the current Serbian government, and this group. For example, investigative journalists determined that while this government had the Minister of Police, during that time, this group grew much stronger because the police was investigating their rival groups, which kind of led to the conclusion that there has been some form of a protection provided by the political elites in power to this particular group. There have been numerous other links confirmed between the government and this group, including the very statement that Believ gave to the prosecutors when he was arrested this year in February. He said that he had met with the president of Serbia and that he had done him some services. For example, he said that he and his group were hired to beat up journalists during the inauguration of the president in 2017. Or there was a deal between the president and him for the Pride Parade in Belgrade to take place because he was a member of the hooligan group as well, who was constantly protesting against the Pride Parade in Belgrade. And once we had the change of the government, there apparently has been a deal between these groups and the establishment that the parade must take place. And then they promised that they will not make any issues about it. And this has been true. We've had Pride Parade taking place ever since. So this is these are the links between the government and this group. And I think the question here that Edward asked is, what is the significance? Right now, I have a working theory, is that the whole Believ affair was actually started because based on the statements by the prosecutor in charge and the minister of earlier minister of interior, is that there has been some evidence given to the Serbian authorities by the internationals, most likely DEA, the US agency, and then the government was actually forced to do something and prosecute this group, although they did so very unwillingly. And what I think now we have at play is an attempt to kind of surgically remove this infantry rank and file tentacle of Believ and his group, but preserve the octopus, the criminal political octopus intact, because this would be just foot soldiers who are currently being tried. And then we are watching very carefully how this case develops. It's going to be seminal for the country. But I think also another important case that is also taking place these days is about the, well, pretty much state-sponsored illegal marijuana production. 2 years ago, just outside of Belgrade, the police found, I think, 12 hectares, the biggest illegal marijuana plantation in Europe, just outside of Belgrade. Again, the person who was in charge of this business model was very close with the government. And then now we have another case in this regard. And the whole government has been used to try to provide coverage to this guy who's currently being sentenced. So the whole government is actually trying to provide defense for this guy, Koluvija, who had this plantation. That is so twisted, if I may say. It's completely, you cannot, how to explain this to somebody coming from the UK. We had a president of Serbia on TV station defending this guy, Koluvija, who was arrested with more than 4 tons of marijuana, claiming that, so what? Marijuana is already kind of legal in Germany and some other countries. So why does he have to be in prison? It's not like he killed somebody. These are his exact words. And this shows how difficult it is to for any kind of prosecutor or investigators to actually prosecute these groups. So just to illustrate.
Okay, thanks very much for explaining all of that. What's the events in Serbia? We have very much entrenched political, economic elite. The links with organized crime seem to be apparent, or at least suggestive from what you've said. In Montenegro, however, we've got a new government, and there's a couple of questions focusing on that. Martin C. asks, has the new Montenegrin government's high-profile arrests of senior figures within the Kotel clans gone any way to disrupting the group's activities in the region? And Sasha Vernovsky asks, what would it take to clean up the influence of organized crime on Balkan politics? And who else is there? Edward Joseph, if I can find him. Okay. Is Belgrade interested in a government of Montenegro that tackles organized crime? So, you know, there may be some openings in Montenegro. What do you think, Vanya?
Yes, absolutely. Okay, I'll start with the last. I think Belgrade is interested in controlling organized crime happening in Montenegro, not stopping it, stopping the part that they cannot control and using the part that they can put under the control. Regarding Kotor arrests, I think that it depends very much on the prosecution. We have never managed to change the prosecution. We haven't managed to change the prosecution yet. And it will depend on the judiciary, which, you know, is still under political control of the previous government. We had other cases with mistakes, intentionally built in indictments. We had quite a few cases related to signing the plea agreements with people from top level organized crime, which were extradited from other countries where other participants, other individuals involved in those crimes were found guilty for like number of years in Montenegro. They got away after a couple of months. So it's the actions of the police are not the guarantee that something is going to be done, even if the government wants, because the prosecution is a problem and judiciary is a problem. Right now, everyone is talking about prosecution. And it's going to be very challenging how they're going to handle that issue without putting it under political control of the new government. But no one is yet talking about judiciary. And that's, of course, that's the stage where we also see huge mistakes being made, in particular in cases related to the top level organized crime. When it comes to, there was a question regarding Bulgaria and Romania. When our major operations of cigarette smuggling moved to Macedonia, then we were smuggling through Romania and Bulgaria and using these connections. These connections might be still used, but not as intensive as in that period while Montenegro was really under pressure for the cigarette smuggling. I think, and now the complicated question, what I think should be done? Well, first, I think that the messages need to be very consistent. I think the messages that, you know, we should fight against crime, and then having a commissioner of the EU sitting down with Mišković, for example, from Serbia, that's a very mixed message, you know. Is he good or bad guy? I mean, how far that can go? So very consistent messages. I understand it's very hard for the EU because they have to have the government as a partner to communicate. And it's very hard for many of the countries to make a decision and to pick between democracy and stability, because organized crime is not the only problem in the Balkans. We get crazy about so many other things. And it's really hard to assess sometimes what needs to be done when it comes to organized crime, because our elites, in particular when we are talking about Djukanovic, he was very flexible in political terms and changing his political attitudes in order to benefit him personally and to benefit the protection of his criminal activities. For example, he did a very brave and smart moves when it comes to the foreign policy. So as soon as he recognized Kosovo, there was another, you know, a round of eyes wide shut on his involvement in organized crime. And maybe that was a smart decision from the perspective of the whole region and the stability of the region. But from the perspective of Montenegro, you know, just saying, well, Montenegro progressed, even though we know it never happened, that wasn't a good decision. I don't know whether I would be able to make better decisions if I had in mind all the problems in the Balkans, but I know that this lack of consistency in messages is certainly harming not only the country's perspectives in democratization, but us that are living in the countries and trying to fight against that evil. Because in the middle of our fight, someone comes from the Brussels or Washington or wherever and says that these people that we have to cope with on a daily basis are actually great guys, great Democrats, and all these things. So I understand that there has to be some you know, some political games there, but just be aware that we even in those times, we still have to live here and survive all that. I think that transparency is one of the keys. I'm a huge advocate for transparency because so many information is hidden in order for us, for NGOs, for journalists, not only from our countries, but also from other countries to be obstructed in performing their job. That's why I think insisting on transparency, but not for transparency per se, but transparency in some specific areas, like transparency in the customs. Why can see the ships coming to the UK and I cannot see the ships coming to Montenegro? What are they carrying? You know, so that kind of stuff, which would really help us to better understand what is happening in some of the currently very, very non-transparent areas. But also, and I will finish with that. I think that if we can look at organized crime from two ways. One is looking at them as alternative to the state, as someone who's enforcing the contracts and you know, all these things related to that theory. But another is looking at them as international multilateral companies, looking at them from the economic perspective, as a huge company which is investing in illicit goods, but not only in illicit goods, because they want to launder the money. So they make decision how much money to put in legitimate businesses and or semi-legitimate businesses and how much money to put into the drugs. We can make it more expensive for them. But making it more expensive for them in Montenegro means that they will move to Croatia or Serbia. So make them more expensive for the whole region. Just one little example. All banks from Montenegro use one correspondent bank, and it's a Deutsche Bank. If the Deutsche Bank introduces certain rules that they have to follow in order to be able to take the money out of the country, then money laundering is going to be much more complicated and much more expensive to be done. So some of the things could be done outside. And lastly, sorry, just this regarding the Panama Papers, that's also, and Pandora Papers, that's also part of the responses. We need open registries. We saw there were some reactions following the Panama Papers, and there were some open establishing the ultimate beneficiary ownership registries in the UK, even in Switzerland, etc. But we need open registries at offshore places. We cannot depend on the leaks. We need open registries in European countries. We need financial documents to be publicly available. Why would countries charge us, NGOs, journalists, to get financial documents of the companies or disable us basically from getting the financial documents of these companies and tracking the money when they know that in our countries, institutions, law enforcement won't do it for various purposes. So just give us more tools and we can help. And why is that important also? Because if our countries, if our police cannot act for various reasons, a police in Germany or UK can act. This is organized crime. It's not simple corruption. It goes over the border. So let's try to make them to go after them in jurisdictions where that can happen, and then use that experience to actually pressure our own guys. So I really think a much more consistency and transparency is needed also by the European actors, because without your country, you know, they don't keep all the money in Montenegro. They go to London. They go to other countries. They go to Europe. They don't want to have apartment in Šavnik or something. They want to have apartment in Paris. So that's why we need public registries online, so we can check whether they have some, you know, apartments in Roma or whatever. But currently, that is not happening. So I think a lot can be done by the Europe itself for fighting the crime there as well and helping us, giving us tools to find out the property of our politicians abroad or the property, of course, of organized crime figures abroad.
Okay, thank you very much, Vanya.
And I apologize for my giant figures from before. I was trying to read your messages on the screen. I apologize for that.
Yes, thank you very much. I mean, I think you're absolutely right that transparency is sort of key issue, and and I'd just like to, if I may, take a step back on that issue, because we're sort of working a little bit in the dark or in the sort of grey area, and so that brings us to the importance of what Anna Maria was saying about measurement, and how do we know how extensive is organised crime in the region? Is it more or less extensive than in other parts of the world? You know, is that also connects with what you were saying about the links between the Western Balkans and the EU and the sort of Deutsche Bank issue. I mean, how pure is Deutsche Bank when it comes to these things? But measurement, you know, in the economic field, people talk a lot about the importance of the informal economy in the Western Balkans, and they estimate that perhaps the informal economy is about 20% of GDP in some countries. And that's a sort of non-transparent, unseen economic activity, much of it legitimate, perhaps some of it illegitimate. But it would be interesting to know what proportion of that informal economy is related to organized crime. You know, is it a large proportion or a small proportion? And it's, I suppose it's easy to get impressed by the examples, but do we know exactly how, or even informally or vaguely, Do we have a guess about how important this is in the actual economies of the region? Okay, Anna Maria.
Thank you. I would really only very briefly want to touch upon this issue because it's extremely important. There are a lot of numbers out there, and from a particular number of cases, I looked at such estimates concretely. For example, there was a very nice estimate cited internationally about the value of prostitution in Croatia, illegal prostitution in Croatia. It took me six months to get to the bottom of it, who created that number, based on what methodology and where it came from. At the end of the day, it was a very nice initiative, so it's not a critique, one should do that, but essentially it came down to the criminal police department in Croatia, bluntly assessing, sitting around and giving it a figure. Yeah, so I don't say that all numbers out there are based on something like that, but that it's basically also what I think is a really big problem, because by providing such essentially unfounded or ungrounded or methodologically unclear numbers, we also I would say hinder proper research on the matter. Yeah, if there were no numbers, at least no methodological solid and empirically backed up numbers, we would surely already have been a few steps more along the line of really developing solid methodology. So my thought would only be especially to investigative journalists, also to be cautious to use such numbers. I mean, there's a lot of numbers. There are numbers about the global value of trafficking in human beings. I mean, that in terms of empirical foundation and methodology is dubious at best. So,
okay, thanks very much. I think we should also pay some attention. Sorry, Walter, do you want to say something about that?
No, I was just going to say that there's increased attention now on illicit financial flows, and people realizing that if most of this organized crime is economically deterministic, then follow the money. That used to be a cliche, but the actual tools for doing this are becoming much more effective. But then you need the cooperation of the private sector as well. And you need the skill sets in financial intelligence units and others to be able to do this. And coming back to a point made earlier by Vanya and a question in the chat, how do we resolve this issue or tackle it more effectively? I really think the support for practitioners is key. And I also support the notion that the weakest link is in the prosecution and the judiciary. There are pretty decent legal frameworks in the Western Balkans to deal with organized crime and corruption. There are also, I think, some very good police services that do cooperate with Europol and Interpol and others. But you get this evidence, and usually then in a big case when it comes to court, that's when you don't get the necessary follow through. So strengthening the institutions, financial intelligence units, anti-corruption services, prosecutors, judges, this level, the problem is the degree of political interference, but that's, I think, where you can make the biggest difference with external support.
Okay, thank you. A very important point. I think I'd like to just take probably what will be the last question, given that we're heading towards 6 o'clock. There's a lot of people are very interested in the question of the impact of the Pandora Papers, which have been mentioned a moment ago. And the question from Rachel Chetham is, does the panel predict any political fallout in the Western Balkans region from the recent Pandora Papers publication? Or should we expect the status quo to continue?
In Serbia, yes. I don't expect. There have been two ministers so far implicated in Pandora Papers, and no reaction. Why? Because pretty much most of the media is under government control. Most of the institutions are captured, so there's nobody who can do anything. This is really the stage that we are at now. It could be maybe different in Montenegro, and why I know for sure that it's not going to happen in Serbia is because, for example, Minister of Finance was found in Pandora Papers, and he was implicated for owning 24 apartments on the Bulgarian seacoast. And our investigative portal from Serbia already discovered this information in 2015, submitted the indictment, talked to the anti-corruption agency, and nobody did anything then. And now that the person in charge, person in question is the Minister of Finance, they're not going to do it. I mean, he is heading the, as the Minister of Finance, this person heads the anti-money laundering office, which should investigate him for his wrongdoing. So this is how paradoxical it is in Serbia.
I think it also depends very much on what the countries outside the Balkans will do and what kind of impact it will have there. When it comes to Montenegro, we will see the institutions announce something, but these institutions are still under control of Mr. Djukanovic. As you know, in Montenegro, we had a case of Mr. Djukanovic and his son and hidden trusts at British Virgin Islands behind the veil of companies based in five countries. But hilariously, Serbia was reporting about Montenegrin case while not reporting about Serbia case at all, which is clearly showing that it's going to be very political. So I think that if there is a willingness of other in Montenegrin case, we need strong cooperation with UK and Switzerland to be able to understand what happened and whether there is some money hidden there. So in our case, it is going to depend on political will of these countries as well, especially Switzerland, which where all the documents are being kept. So that's why I think that it is going to depend on the attitude of the stronger countries, how much we will be able to do, even if we want to do. I have to apologize to you. I have to run away. I have a debate with the special prosecutor tonight. It's going to be very exciting. And I really apologize, but I would have to leave you. I have so many phone calls already about people wanting to ask questions to him. I apologize and thank you very much for this opportunity.
Okay, thank you very much, Vanya. It's been fascinating listening to you. I think we're going to be thrown out of the Zoom in a couple of minutes. Perhaps Anna Maria, would you like to comment from a legal perspective on the Pandora Papers, Croatian/legal perspective? Do you have any thoughts about the implications of that for the Western Balkans?
So in a nutshell, because we are very brief and it's not that simple to explain legal implications in like 1 minute, mm-hmm. I would say in general, so all the countries throughout the Balkans, and when I talk about the Balkans, that's a bit broader concept than only the Western Balkans, including Romania and Bulgaria. These are all countries that have set up a very strong and very good legal framework to combat organized crime. Mm-hmm. They also have set up the institutions to do that work, and they also have the staff. So I would say the problem of norms and institutions is merely a precondition to fight organized crime. Yeah, but it is not the solution. So we see this in Croatia that has long entered the European Union. We have had a great legal framework before that. We have a great legal framework now, but we have the institutions. But in terms of really prosecuting organized crime, I wouldn't say there is a huge difference between Croatia, Serbia, Bosnia, or Albania. Yeah? What is really lacking is the political will to do so.
Okay, well, I think that's a very good note on which to finish the seminar. We need to support the middle layer officials and find the political will. I think that's the message, one or two of many that I've picked up. So I'd like to thank very much the audience for all their questions, which are pouring in. I'm very sorry we don't have time to deal with all of them. And to our speakers who've given us a fantastic insight and framework for thinking about all of this. So thank you very much. I think we should probably close there. Okay, bye.